Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, Insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you wherever you may be. This is your host, Bruce Ash, welcoming you to a special Independence Day edition of Inside Track. In a few moments, I'll share some thoughts on the news of the week, and then I'll speak with author Tracy Campbell about his newly published book, The Year of Peril, America in 1942. We'll speak with Inside Track DC contributor, old friend of the show, African-American political activist Raynard Jackson, about his newest columns about the great election of 2020. Hey, do you have a home improvement project you want to start this summer and are worried if you can afford the luxury you deserve? Corazon Cabinets sells quality J&K, Conestoga, and Yorktown cabinets, plus offers professional design services for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets today at 488-2266 to schedule an appointment to visit the showroom. 488-2266. Tell Joy, Allie, or David you heard this ad with Bruce on Inside Track and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. Let me share some thoughts on the news of this past week. We have witnessed some pretty tough images of mobs, no, not peaceful protests, attacking individuals, first responders, institutions, monuments, and statues in an effort to redress grievances, which are centuries old, by men and women who live today in one of the fairest and most racially and culturally diverse nations in world history. Despite the arguments being made by mob leaders that America is so racist and so undemocratic, when you consider the countries they want America to emulate, like China, Russia, and Nazi Germany, who would have killed them in the streets or locked them up forever, they are free to protest is proof that our Constitution works. America is not a perfect country. Far from it. On this high holiday of freedom, though, let's recite the preamble of the U.S. Constitution and bring us back to our base. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Those words are still stirring today. And America is still working to form that perfect union, working as hard as ever to ensure domestic tranquility and to promote the general welfare for every American. We're not there yet, but we are further along in the pursuit of all of our liberties and blessings than ever before. We are not always the shining city on the hill, but millions have fought to make it so. And many millions more have come here to find the freedom they could not obtain living anywhere else before. It seems to me that most of what we've seen in the past few weeks is not about George Floyd. It's about waging war over the 2020 election in our streets. However, I give credence. There is still need to correct the fires of past prejudice. So let's talk about some standards for perhaps how we honor Americans from the past that make some sense. Hugh Hewitt, a national radio talk show host on KVOI, said it well this week. 18th century Americans should not be judged by 21st century standards. Washington, Jefferson, and the other framers and founders did far more good than ill. Talk about condemning these men or abandoning our national anthem are misguided, no matter how noble some may see them. 19th century Americans must be judged through the prism of the Civil War. Those who committed treason should rightfully be judged in balance for the good they did and the consequences of slavery and discrimination they espoused. Even the Southern Democrats who fought for slavery deserve to be judged harshly, but not be wiped clean from the history books. Future generations must be able to continue learning the lessons from their mistakes and ill will to others. It makes sense that U.S. military bases, named for Civil War generals and heroes, ought to be retired in favor of those who fought and stood for freedom. However, 20th century Democrat leaders like Woodrow Wilson, Orville Faubus, George Wallace, and John Stennis, plus others of their ilk, must be treated in the context not only by the Civil War, but by constitutional changes that came out of the end of slavery and the Emancipation. By the turn of the 20th century, our nation had changed fundamentally, but they still promoted racism and undemocratic beliefs. I endorse the carrier Stennis be named for Doris Miller, as has been discussed. Stennis was an awful man dedicated to segregation and hatred. The Woodrow Wilson Center at Princeton ought to be named for Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a man of great decency and wisdom in America. And I'm going to bring things local for just a moment and say here in Tucson, where I live, the statue of Pancho Villa, a known killer, the man responsible for the only attack by a foreign power on mainland America, ought to be retired for this 1960s Latino symbol for liberty, dignity of American workers, Cesar Chavez. We already have a city holiday named for him, honoring his name and his life on one of the busiest thoroughfares in Tucson would send a much different message than honoring a murderer like Pancho Villa, despite the howls of unfairness we'd likely hear from Raul Cahalva and his crowd. On this Independence Day, let's all work harder to preserve liberty, to promote tranquility and public good, to work for that more perfect union the framers and founders intended. Tom, let's go ahead and take a quick break for some messages from our great supporters. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back with author Tracy Campbell. Stay tuned. Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it, just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911, 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. I'm pleased to welcome author Tracy Campbell, a history professor at the University of Kentucky, specializes in 20th century political and social history. He's an author of five books, including The Fall and Redemption of Edward F. Pritchard, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 1998. Dr. Campbell has a new book just published titled The Year in Peril, America in 1942, which chronicles America in the first year of the Second World War. Now, a review of the book recently appeared in the review section of the Wall Street Journal and was described like this. Some books appear just at the appropriate moment. Consider a nation struck suddenly from outside and with great loss of innocent life, emergency legislation and lockdowns put in place, the largest emergency spending programs in all of U.S. history, enormous, really frightening deficit spending announced, a controversial president both hated and adored, faced with a moment calling for national unity, a crisis that shows up, divides among the races in America, the divide between liberal coasts and more conservative South and prairie states, the tug between internationalism and go-it-alone-ism. Welcome to the show, Tracy. When you started this book, you probably never could have imagined America in 2020 would be facing the similar kind of conditions that we faced at the beginning of World War II.
Thanks for having me, Bruce. No, and when I finished the book, actually, about 6 months ago, I remember writing, you're probably not going to recognize what we're talking about, but stores are telling people not to buy too much and to only get what you need and to think about what other people might need. And I remember thinking, who is going to identify with this? So it's a little eerie because I started thinking about the book in the middle of the 2008 financial crisis. And so it was born and it appeared now in the book ended by two separate crises. You're right.
So we had in World War II, and now with the pandemic, we have a foreign threat that had attacked us, one being a virus and one being an actual Navy. FDR, like Trump, is both adored and is thought of as being an extraordinarily polarizing figure, and Americans divided on politics and geographics. You know, but we've had a lot of events in history where the nation was in peril and teetered on collapse. What made 1942 different?
I think you could tell a lot about an individual or a society and anything in between when you place under great stress. And for me, it was a notion of there's really not quite a moment in the 20th century like those months after Pearl Harbor, where FDR, in fact, didn't call it World War II. He called it the Survival War, in that we were fighting for our very survival. And I wanted to try and understand what a society looked like when it's under that kind of stress, when people are wondering, are we going to make it to the next month? Are we going to make it through the year? So you're right. FDR was both adored and reviled, but at one point in 1942, he had an 85% approval rating. He'd been president for 10 years at that point. So people felt comfortable with him in the White House. But 1942, as I went back and really tried to get deep inside the sources, was a year of frustration along so many lines, because for FDR and for the administration, there were gas rations, food rationings, higher taxes, and month after month of waiting for the offensive to really start against Hitler, and it didn't happen until November. So 42, it seemed to me, was a year of great frustration for a lot of people.
So most of us know the chronology of the battles abroad, but tell us about our national leadership and how the government handled the emergency domestically after Pearl Harbor, just at the beginning of, as you described, the survival war.
The first thing they had to deal with was a spending program unlike anything we'd ever seen before. A few years earlier, when Roosevelt had called for about $1 billion in spending for defense, it was seen as an outrageous amount. So in 1942, when he calls for nearly $59 billion, it's an astronomical sum, and of course, just kept growing and growing. And so one of the things they had to do was, first of all, contain inflation, which was done through a government agency called the Office of Price Administration, which essentially determined the price of just about everything. I remember looking at one particular office called something like the Biscuit and Pretzel Subcommittee of the War Production Board, and these were people who were trying to decide the price of pretzels. And so everything essentially would be planned at a bureaucratic level, which produced a great deal of frustration, a great deal of anxiety, but it also, on the other hand, kept inflation in check. If you don't do that and the price of goods just escalates, then war spending, taxes, all of it kind of reduces to being meaningless, and that could have had a profound impact on the war.
So your book proceeds month to month during 1942. And the thing that I really like about your book, Peril in America, is you use official documents, letters, private diaries, some polling information, and local newspapers in provincial areas of America to really develop a feel for the time that Americans faced during 1942, didn't you?
I first of all started off thinking thematically. There ought to be a chapter about politics. There ought to be a chapter about economics, a chapter about the election. And I kept stopping and starting. And one of the things I did was I read various newspapers day to day, page by page, as the year progressed to kind of get myself deep inside the year. And I wanted to try and relate that to the reader to see the kind of tension, the kind of push and pull that was happening. Because in January and February, fear of the next wave, fear of the next attack, dominate so much of American life. And so I thought maybe I could take the reader through the year as it progressed to try and see what it felt like to be inside that year. It's an enormous challenge, but I think sometimes we read history backward. We know how it's going to end up. So, of course, we're going to succeed by 1945, but nobody knows that, you know, in January and February of 1942, where the fear is gripping so much of the country.
So how much different was the mood in major cities of the East and West Coasts versus the interior of the country in 1942?
I assumed that that was going to be the feeling. Of course, if you're living in Los Angeles or Washington, D.C., the fear of a coastal attack has to be there. But on the other hand, the blackout that occurred, in which cities would be told at night, you're going to have to turn off every single light so it's not a beacon to, you know, possible enemy attack. The biggest one occurred in November. I mean, 11 months into the year, throughout the Midwest in places like Montana. And that was one thing. Another thing I found was that the federal government backed an insurance program so that you could insure your property, your home, your business against any kind of enemy attack. And so I thought, I need to go through and see where these policies were taken out. And I found some in Iowa, Indiana, near Chicago. So really, wherever you could be, people felt like that there was a possibility of an attack. Whether it came from the air or whether it came from saboteurs, that feeling, I think, was as strong sometimes within the country as it was on the coast.
So you did a Google search of the word democracy in 1942, and you found, I think I'm getting this right, that that word democracy was like the highlight word used during that particular year, wasn't it?
It's a search engine called Ingram, and you can apply a name, a phrase, a term, and what Google will do is look through all of the written record that it has going back to the 1700s and see the frequency with which a word has been used. So if you put in John F. Kennedy, you would see in the 60s it peaks and then falls away. Well, I was at an event, I had took my phone out and I just plugged in the word democracy, and I saw this peak happening around the 1940s, and I kept blowing it up thinking, surely it's not going to be the case. Well, there it was. The year in which the word was used more than any other since the founding of the country was in 1942. And as I got inside the year, I realized that that made sense because so much was at stake in 1942. The very idea of self-government, of free government, was really on the line. So that's why I think it's no coincidence it was used so much.
So democracy was the key word of that year, but there were internments that started occurring in 1942. How much did the general public know about the internments, and was this really a very democratic way to be treating Japanese and Germans and Italians at that time?
Well, of course not, and it's one of the darker moments, but like I said, if I did a chapter on internments, it seems to exist in a vacuum, but if you look at it through the lens afforded by going through the year and seeing just how intense that fear was, the notion was, let's not take any chances, according to the administration. And that's why FDR getting so much pressure from various places, particularly in California, that there were new saboteur programs. General John DeWitt, who was really the head of the program, was asked about it in February and said, you know, there's not really been any kind of sabotage by anyone. He said, well, that just proves that they're waiting. So the fact that nothing had happened, at least in his mind, was proof that it would happen. And so the first executive order, which is 9066 in February of 42, actually referred to German Americans and Italian Americans, as well as Japanese Americans, as enemy aliens. The sheer fact that there were so many throughout the country, and it's an election year, I think, negated the fact that there would be any kind of internment camps for a lot of people. But for Japanese Americans, it became a point where over 100,000 were interned throughout the West Coast. And so if you're interested in civil liberties, if you're interested in the rights of Americans, that is really one of the darker moments, certainly one of the great criticisms launched toward Franklin Roosevelt and the administration.
And did people generally know about the internments? What was the general mood of John Q. public during that time?
It's hard to gauge what the general mood was. There certainly wasn't a lot of protest. There wasn't a lot of outrage about it because there was so much going on. When I looked at some of the letters that were being sent to the White House, and I looked at some of the records in California, there were just tons and tons of material going to whether it's the local agencies or the federal agencies, worried about what anyone who might look different might do. So part of what this book is about is looking at race and looking at the kind of anger that was fueled by these kinds of moments. One of the things I was not expecting to do was look at the whole idea of rumors. But the federal government tried to catalog the things that people were telling each other in 1942. And in Washington, I went through just file after file of, if you want to call it fake news or misinformation, about what people were telling each other. And the biggest single category was called hate, H-A-T-E. And so that kind of racial hatred, whether it's toward Japanese Americans, African Americans, Jewish Americans, kind of proliferated in this environment of fear and anger and national anxiety.
So there was great social change in America starting in 1942 because of the mobilization, females in the workplace, African Americans in the workplace, far, far more than, you know, maybe had ever been in the past. What kind of social turmoil and social change came as a result of these changes in the geographic locations of African Americans particularly, and also females entering the workplace?
Well, by sheer necessity, we needed people to work in these war industries to produce what Franklin Roosevelt had said. We need 60,000 planes in 1942. We need 125,000 in 1943. So there was this kind of mania to produce and produce and produce. And if you've got millions going to the European or Pacific theater, there is a need for work. So it's one of those transformations in 1942 where we start the year off with double-digit employment, and by the end of the year, it's less than three because of this need. So for African Americans, they move to from the South to the Midwest to the North to work in some of these factories. For women, obviously, it was a chance to finally get out of the house and to do the jobs that up to that point had been seen as only a male thing, you know, whether it's operating cranes or welding or the like. But we shouldn't get lost in the notion of thinking that all had changed forever, because there was still tremendous discrimination against both groups at the workplace, whether it was wages or the way they were treated. And there were a lot of protests. There was a great deal of anger throughout the country when African Americans moved into a whites-only housing project in Detroit. It produced a near riot of hundreds of people bringing, you know, bricks and bats and broken bottles to try and keep the area a whites-only area. And, of course, the military remained segregated, and even our blood supply, according to the American Red Cross, would have to be separated in terms of race. So the mixed record, it's opportunities offered and opportunities lost during those early years of the war.
So Tracy, are there lessons to be learned from 1942, that year of peril, to today in 2020 with the virus and the changes in mobility that have been imposed on people, as well as the fear and so on that goes on with respect to the next wave of the illness and so on? Is there anything, you know, I realize all this has happened post the writing of your book, but in looking back at 1942, what might we learn from that time to help us today going forward?
Well, it's an extremely important question. Let me give you a specific example that might serve as a beacon. One of the specific consequences of the attack at Pearl Harbor was the Japanese were able to cut off almost all the rubber supplies to the United States. Without rubber, there is no arsenal of democracy. Without rubber, there is no victory. I mean, it is so crucial. And we need rubber, and we need it right now. And so Roosevelt went on the radio and said, I want to talk about rubber, and I mean rubber. And in order to determine just what we had, he asked citizens to do something over the next 2 weeks in June of 1942. He said, go to your basements, go to your garages, find every extent use of rubber you can, take it to your local, what he called, filling station, and let's see just how much rubber we've got. So everyone, regardless of age, particularly children, could go around their neighborhoods and collect rubber, take it to a local filling station, and within a month we had collected almost a 500,000 tons of rubber. But there you go. There is a notion of clear, consistent leadership saying what the real goal is, giving people something to do so that they could contribute to the national cause. But one of the things that I found about 1942 was the word sacrifice was used over and over, that everyone, no matter what you were, whether you were like 20 years old and my father, who was drafted that year, the sacrifice might mean the ultimate sacrifice, or it might mean not little more than you're not going to have more than 3 gallons of gas this week. But in 1942, the government, and whether it's at the local level, state, or national level, said there is something each of us can do for something bigger than yourself. And so maybe that is the ultimate lesson, this dual notion of both service and doing something and sacrifice, whether it's you might be paying higher taxes, you might be working at a defense plant, you might be volunteering at a hospital. There is something for you to do.
Tracy, how do people find your book and what versions are available?
It's virtually anywhere online. It's in hardback, but it's also an audio book that is available as well on all the major lines. So if they're interested, it's pretty available.
So just tell everybody the title of your book again.
A Year of Peril. The subtitle is America in 1942.
It's a great education for people to have a chance to glimpse back into that part of World War II that hasn't been written about very much. Tracy, thanks very much for joining us today. We need to leave it right here for now. You've written a very, very good book that any American interested in World War II in history and how government worked at the time ought to read. And thanks again.
Bruce, thanks so much for having me.
All right. We'll be right back after these messages, speaking with Republican African-American political activist Raynard Jackson. You're listening to Inside Track. Stay tuned. I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest for the balance of the show is friend, political ally, sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree, political spokesman, and now consultant to the president, Raynard Jackson. Raynard, welcome to the show. Where are you calling from today?
Well, Bruce, thank you for having me on your show. I'm calling from the swamp today out in D.C., so it's knee-deep here, and we're trying to hopefully get another 4 years for the president to clean this up.
And he's wise to listen to. As I said above, the president and you have met, and he's listening to you about communicating to African-American communities across America. Can you tell us about your conversation with the president and what you told him and what he might have taken away from your conversation?
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, it was a very interesting meeting, and I wish the public could see the president in private like I saw him and juxtapose that with the public persona that the media is trying to create for this president. But no, it was very candid, Bruce, and I was told that the president doesn't like and want people to sugarcoat anything, so anything I had to say, I should be very honest and upfront with the president, and I was, and we discussed about a lot of the great things the president has done relative to the black community, but I think the Achilles heel of this administration and the conservative movement, as you and I have talked about, has been the lack of effective communication directly to the black community. And he looked at me and said, you know what, that's a valid point, and I agree with you. And he said, definitely, I want my staff to follow up with you, and let's come up and execute some of the ideas you have, because I gave him a lot of ideas that you and I have had private conversations with Bruce, and so he was very attentive, and I'm looking forward to working with the White House team and the campaign to move his agenda forward.
Well, they'd be wise to listen to you. You know, I think you've said it in one of your columns that if you're trying to learn something about gymnastics or water ballet, you're not going to go to Michael Jordan, you know, the basketball hero, as a spokesman. So why not listen to people who have worked in the African-American community, understand that community, and have overriding sense of devotion to wanting to see the president reelected if you really want to win that vote, right?
Without question. And Bruce, I often tell people, and we laugh about it, I said, having a black around you, Bruce, is not the same as having the right black around
yeah.
you. I mean, you and I both are businessmen, Bruce, and so when we're hiring people, you may have two candidates that have almost identical backgrounds on their resume. So what you need to determine and look at the resumes, when I bring them in for an interview, which of these two candidates, since on the competence and the technical aspects of the resume are identical, which is a better fit for who I am as an owner and a manager, and who will fit into my corporate culture better? That's what conservatives need to understand, Bruce. Just because a person is black does not mean they need to be the spokesperson for what you're doing. They may be a great person, but wrong for that particular job.
Right. So, Renard, you've written that leftists in the media have been feeding lies to African Americans for decades, probably no more apparent than today, considering the great economic and educational gains of the past 3.5 years within the black community. Am I talking sense? Do you agree with what I just said?
Oh, without question. And to me, if I am sick and I have a liberal Democrat physician approach me and say, hey, I understand what you're going through. Here's the solution to your problem in the form of these tablets. Again, Bruce, I'm not interested in whether he's Democrat or Republican. I just want to feel better. And if that liberal can offer a prescription to cure my pain, guess what, Bruce? I'm going to take it. And the same thing with conservatism, Bruce. We know liberalism has failed the black community. Black liberals, Joy Reid, Roland Martin, Don Lemon, they know liberal policy have failed the black community, Bruce, but they refuse to give a public platform to people like me and others who can go out there and speak directly to the black community. So that presents that opening that I've been talking to you about for years within the conservative movement, that we can go and bring the black vote onto our side. We don't need to persuade them and get them to agree with that. We already agree with on the issues. It's just a matter of welcoming it into the fold and making us feel like we are part of the team.
So why do black Americans believe what people like Don Lemon and Joy Reid and Roland Martin say about Trumps and conservatives in general? In fact, why would any American believe these people when they've lied so many times?
You drank in the liberal Kool-Aid. You've fallen prey to their trap. Your premise is factually flawed. It's not that the black community listens to these liberals. It's that these black liberals, Bruce, they're only going to bring folks on that represent their viewpoint. They're not going to bring in a lot of blacks and just regular citizens in Chicago, Baltimore, Ferguson, who are not political junkies like you and I, Bruce. We eat, sleep, and drink this stuff, but the average American citizen is just going to work every day trying to provide for their family. But if you go into the hood of Chicago where all these shootings are going to, I guarantee you, Bruce, you're going to hear nothing but conservative conversation about the need to reunify the black family, to get better at school system, and to have economic development within their neighborhoods. You're not going to sit up and hear a lot of conversation about, well, what is the government going to give me? I can guarantee you, Bruce. And so CNN, MSNBC, they are not going to showcase people who are talking that way. So they're only going to put people on their networks espouse the narrative they want to create. And so basically what they're doing, they're trying to create the impression that they're thinking they are the norm and all the blacks that you and I are talking about, Bruce, somehow we're unicorn, and it's just the opposite.
So really the conversations that go on in the black community or the Latino community or the Jewish community or the Catholic community or any community, they're all pretty much the same then. I mean, they, you know, people want to know that they live in a secure place and that their kids have a chance for a good education and so on. Is that what you're saying?
Without question, Bruce. And again, that's why I'm always glad to talk to you, because you really get this issue of getting more blacks involved in the conservative movement. I don't have to explain and educate you. You intrinsically get it. You just need to be told, okay, what doors do you need me to be helpful to, mm-hmm. to open for you so you can go in there and do what you're good at? Because, again, Bruce, you have enough wisdom to realize that you walking into the black community talking like you and I talk, yeah, you could do it, but kind of the optics of it is kind of weird. It makes more sense to, for me being a black person coming from the community to be front and center versus you. No more, just like it makes more sense to have a Jewish person go speak to a group from the Jewish community versus a black who I am a Baptist when it comes to religion. So just being smart on the communication side, Bruce, is not that you could not say the same thing that I say, you understand it. But I think coming from me, it would resonate better. And that's just a reality. It has nothing to do with, you know, me being obsessed with your color or this or that. It's just people like to interact with people they're familiar with.
Yeah. In their June 13th column, you wrote, quote, "It is journalistic malpractice for these quasi-journalists to obsessively spread this type of dogma to their people, knowing the detrimental effects it's having on the black community. Trump is not the problem in the black community. Republicans are not the problem in the black community. Capitalism is not the problem in the black community. Liberalism is the problem in the black community." Those are pretty strong words.
And they're true. Well, you know, the thing about it is, Bruce, I know a lot of these supposedly, you know, big shot black journalists, you know, from the CNNs, et cetera. We'll go out to drink, et cetera. When you hear them in private conversation, they don't believe half the stuff they're spewing out over there. Remember, what, 2 years ago with Joy Reid, who got caught in the hand with her hand in the cookie jar? She does not support homosexuality, and she's about to receive this big award. When they found out in her private writing, she did not support homosexuality. She was doing it all as a persona. They, you know, revoked the awarding to her. So my point is, Bruce, she doesn't even believe in this homosexual agenda, but in order to keep her job, she'll get on TV every night and just push whatever the talking points are. And so what we need to do in the conservative movement, Bruce, is make sure we go into the black community and we talk to the black entrepreneurs. We talk to the mother who wants to send her kid to a private school if we can ever get school choice and vouchers in her community. Those are the people who are going to change America. But if you go to the liberal elite, the Don Lemon, the Joy Reid, the NAACP, you're going to get that liberal dogma that they've been spoon-fed as well.
You had a chance to meet with President Trump. There might have been a few other people in the room, but you probably had an opportunity, if not maybe nose to nose, certainly to look at them and look them straight in the eye. Do you think American black lives, American black lives matter to President Trump?
We've talked about it for a few minutes. And let me tell you something, Bruce. This whole notion of black lives matter is the typical Saul Alinsky playbook. Now, you notice that in the late 60s, early 70s, feminism started going into the black community and they started pushing black faces out of it, even though white liberal elite women were pulling all the strings. And the same thing, if you look at the NAACP and the Urban League, they push out black faces, but it's really the liberal elites who are controlling those organizations. And so with Black Lives Matter, yeah, you have black faces, but if you go on their website, Bruce, it's stunning that they put on their own website, their goal is to promote homosexuality, transgender, get rid of capitalism, and destroy America. That's on their own website, Bruce.
Yeah, I know that I went to the Black Lives Matter website, hit the donate button, and strangely, although maybe not so strange, their donate button, when you hit it, sent money right to Act Blue, which is the DNC, their prime vehicle for small donor gifts. I mean, it's amazing. I now refer to the Democratic Party as the Black Lives Matter Democrat Party because the two of them are aligned at the hips, it seems.
There is no daylight between them. But again, you know, within the Democratic Party, Black Lives Matter would be considered part of, better to the left of AOC and those four women, Bruce. And so they are the most radical of the most radical of the radical on the liberal spectrum. But you know what's amazing, Bruce? The Fortune 50 companies are giving money to Black Lives Matter. I'm talking about Facebook, Google, the NBA, NFL, National Hockey League. When are conservatives going to call these leagues and these major corporations to the table and say, hey, you're funding all these liberal causes, but yet you constantly come to us as elected officials to help you with legislative priorities, but yet you give no money to any black conservatives. Why is that?
That is one of the most profound things I've heard in a long time. And it is a wonderment. You know, it's almost as though corporate America is so afraid of being called out by certain groups that they forget that it's the institution, it's the momentum of America that has created their great wealth.
Without question, Bruce. And I'm hoping next month, after the 4th of July, I can either talk on the phone or meet with some of our elected officials here in the Congress because, Bruce, again, why are you going to continue to help these major companies with their legislative priorities, but yet they find your enemies to defeat you? So if you get defeated, do you think these radical leftist people are going to be supportive of the corporate agenda? Of course not. So why are they continuing to fund their opposition?
Great point. I want to use your eloquent words once again from your June 13th column. It was liberalism that took the male out of the home in the 60s. It was liberalism that injected black women with the cancer of feminism in the 70s. It was liberalism that destroyed the educational system in the 80s. It was liberalism that unleashed the prison pipeline into the black community in the 90s. It was liberalism that destroyed the inner cities in the 2000s with crack and high taxes. Where are all the riots and protests breaking out? Cities like Baltimore, Atlanta, Minneapolis, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City, St. Louis, to name a few. What do they all have in common? They're all run by radical liberal mayors, city councils, and district attorneys. I mean, that's really saying it like it is.
Without question, and Bruce, that's why I get so frustrated a lot of times when you and I talk privately. I know the conservative message resonates because I'm telling you, if you look at most of these athletes and entertainers, these icons like LeBron James and even President Obama, if you look at the way they live their personal life, LeBron James is about as conservative as they come. He's been married to the same girl since they were dating in high school. Mm-hmm. He's got 3 or 4 kids. So that intact family, he is clearly the man of the household. And so if and when his sons get out of line, he is the one to swiftly inflict discipline upon them. Doesn't that sound conservative to you, Bruce?
Pretty conservative to me.
But yet they get out there and espouse public policies that are antithetical to the way they live their life. Another good example, that the rapper Ice Cube, is now the TV star Ice Cube, do you realize he's been married to the same girl for over 20 years?
Yep, I know that, yeah.
You know, intact family, but yet they'll go out here espousing policies that they wouldn't want their kids to live by. And so, again, I'm saying within the conservative movement, Bruce, there is an opening if the conservative movement were to help fund initiatives like you and Randy Pullen there in Arizona have been very supportive. What I'm trying to do through my super PAC and C4, which is to go directly to the conservative black entrepreneur and use them as a gateway into the black community. And, you know, we're getting traction. It's working. But, Bruce, the message is not the problem. The only thing the movement needs to do is to make black folks feel like they're invited and they can and want to be a part of the solution. That's what's needed.
In the black communities across America, if their friends or if their family knew that they had voted for Donald Trump in 2020, would they be referred to as an Uncle Tom?
Oh, without question. Without question.
So there's great shame that's foisted on them for anybody who publicly says that they're in support of conservatives.
Well, yeah, but part of it, again, and Bruce, I keep putting the blame squarely back on the conservative movement because we have allowed our movement to be so vilified in the media that it is a scarlet letter in general to be conservative, whether you're black or white, but more specifically in the black community. But until we, Bruce, as conservatives, start making it cool to be conservative, almost like what Reagan did. Because remember, prior to Reagan in 1980, this country was far left liberal with Jimmy Carter and all that stuff. Reagan brought a coolness to conservatism, yes, even out in liberal Hollywood when he was president for two terms. So who are the cool conservatives that we have out there? I don't see any of them because our leadership on the congressional level, Bruce, is so isolated. When have you seen McCarthy or McConnell ever surround themselves with a bunch of black entrepreneurs? I haven't.
Can the president do better with black voters in 2020? And what must the Trump campaign do to win more of the African-American vote in this upcoming election?
The answer is yes to all those questions. And what he needs to do is just quoting all the statistics, the low black unemployment rate, what he's done with the HBCU black colleges, what he's done with criminal justice reform. We need to have credible blacks, Bruce, like myself, Bob Woodson, Bob Brown, Herman Cain. They need to visually see more of us with the president, the vice president, his cabinet members, and other Republicans, even like you in Arizona, Bruce. They need to have the optics, the videos, and photos of us working together. That will go a long ways towards rehabilitating the conservative brand within the black community.
Will a Trump second term do more for the American black community than if Joe Biden wins this election?
Oh, Trump second term, but it is not even a question because Vice President Biden will go so far left and he's going to bring in 30 million folks, illegals on amnesty. He's going to bring in all these Indians from overseas, H-1B visas holders to take technology jobs. He's going to put all of his energy into the homosexual agenda and none of that benefits the black community, Bruce, none of it.
Well, Reynard, we're going to have to leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today. And I want to close with a point of personal privilege. I know my friend Reynard will appreciate. Today is the birthday of our country, also the show's founder, Emil Fransley, who sadly passed June 7th, 2017. To this day, every show that we've done and every show forward, there's some part of his great spirit and legacy that's embodied in each of our broadcasts. I certainly can never expect to be as wise or as colorful as Franzi, but we'll keep telling it like it is for as long as we're on the air. We miss you, friend. And until next week for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash wishing you a very happy 4th of July, also celebrating our country's birth, wherever you may be.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrap yard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.